welcome back to another episode of the Strategy Inside Everything. This should be a unique, a different kind of episode from what we normally do. We have a speaker who is in the media a lot and is also a professor of media design, the associate professor of media design at the Parsons School of Design, Professor David Carroll. How are you, sir?
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Should I call you Professor or should I call you David or Dave or how do you like to be called?
I get called by all three depending on the context, but we can be casual here and you can just call me Dave if you want.
You got it. As I was emailing you, I was like, should I keep saying Professor or where's the line here?
Some of that just probably comes from my Twitter handle, which has Prof. Carroll in it. And that's mostly just because David Carroll is actually a really common name. So I had to come up with some unique identifier.
Very good. Very good. Well, if you're listening to this and you're saying, oh yeah, Prof. Carroll, why do I know that name? Would you like David to tell people a little bit about what you've been doing recently and why they've probably have
sure.
heard your name?
Well, I may have been known in marketing and publishing circles prior to the Cambridge Analytica scandal because I was a tech entrepreneur at one point. In fact, while I was trying to commercialize my academic work into the industry, the beginnings of the Cambridge Analytica Facebook scandal were going on in 2014, 2015. So I'm most well known now for taking on Cambridge Analytica in British courts to try and gain some transparency into this very opaque world. So I've been getting some coverage by the media for this campaign, which sometimes referred to as a data quest, basically trying to see if the European data protection model can potentially have an impact on American democracy and elections because of the way that our data was processed in England in 2016. So a really interesting project, very relevant, and what started as sort of an academic inquiry into figuring out how this industry works, found myself in the middle of international intrigue and investigations and cloak and dagger type world.
Now, did not set out to get embroiled in all that, I'm sure. Did it start out kind of just natural curiosity and trying to pull at the thread and see where it took you? Or did you think you were going to be upsetting the apple cart to the extent that you are?
It's a great question. I think it's a little of both, meaning my students at Parsons, you know, end up trying to decide between job offers at amazing tech companies like Google, Facebook, Palantir, Vimeo, et cetera. And so part of my job is figuring out this industry so that we can prepare students for it and help them figure out what they're getting into. So on the normal course of my work, even as a sort of now former failed entrepreneur, there's been always a curiosity about the industry. And I've always sort of been a part of the industry, whether it was during my client-facing days in the early 2000s or my sort of product-facing days when I was a tech entrepreneur in like 2013, 14, 15, before all of this exploded. I've always sort of been well-positioned, sort of in the right place at the right time. And so some of this was just that, of being here and knowing what to look for. Exactly.
Natural curiosity. Yeah. Tell me about the business that you started as an entrepreneur. Not, you don't have to sell the business, but just kind of what area was it in?
Well, there's nothing to sell because it's defunct.
Right.
But it's an interesting story of trying to commercialize academic work in the ad tech and publishing tech sort of saturated world. This was, again, five years ago almost. I had research sponsored by Hearst, actually, through the NYC Media Lab, which is a consortium of media companies, telecom companies, cable, ad agencies, and et cetera, and the universities in New York City. And so there's a lot of sort of sponsored research. And we were able to develop some interesting product around the Hearst API at the time. And we presented it to the C-suite at the end of the project. And as a sort of joke, I said, well, you know, they asked, well, what now? And I said, well, you'd have to start a company to keep working on this. And they said, well, you should do that. And that was not the response I was expecting, because I said it as a sort of a professorly joke. But they did write me a check, and I did try to start the company. But it did not work out for many different reasons. That's sort of the subject of its own podcast, I suppose. But I did sort of, that's how I sort of got into this world of the ad tech industrial complex, learned about the Lumascape, sort of worked and met one-on-one publishers and saw how the whole digital marketing ecosystem had evolved since I first got into it back in the early 2000s.
Well, that's really interesting. Isn't it funny how quick someone else is to say you should make that a business when it's not their skin on the game, or, you know, when they're like, yeah, you should go start that business. And as a strategist, I love that data because it informs direction. It'll help make it more efficient and help my clients, and it'll help us understand who we're building these products for. But as a consumer and as a human, I'm conflicted because I say, well, where, at what point is it intrusive? Is it intrusive if, is it only intrusive if I know this is Joe Smith and this is his personal spending data, or even at an aggregate level, like, where's the line? And I suspect you wrestled with some of those same questions as you started learning more and more about how this data is processed and available.
Sure. Great. So I think that the Cambridge Analytica scandal is the watershed moment that has triggered a renegotiation of tracing out the contours of where we can and should draw the line, and have also happened at the same time that the GDPR went to effect. And we're seeing the kind of Brussels effect more broadly as a result of that we can loosely term the European model of data privacy and how it contrasts with the US model. And in the aftermath of the scandal, we're seeing on Capitol Hill a appetite for regulating data and technology in a way that would be unthinkable before Cambridge Analytica. And
are you feeling that that's a real response, that that appetite really does exist? I mean, is there an actual opportunity for renegotiation, or is it more just at the academic level people are receptive to it?
It's a sort of long, sort of opaque and amorphous process. so it's hard to pin it down. But certainly we have heard, just listening to the testimonies that have been in the Senate and House hearings related to the aftermath, we hear Republican lawmakers and Democrat lawmakers alike referencing the European model, asking witnesses about its pros and cons. And you even hear like back channel conversations between folks like Christopher Wiley, the Cambridge Analytica whistleblower, and former clients of Cambridge Analytica, like Senator Ted Cruz, when Wiley went to testify, you know, even behind the scenes, Cruz told Wiley, you know, we've got to do something about this. And so there is a sense of something needs to give because we're seeing broad impacts. And I think one of the things we're learning is that prior to Cambridge Analytica, it's sort of like, you know, AD and BC in terms of like a great cataclysm, and we refer to it now that way, you know, almost jokingly. But before Cambridge Analytica, the argument was that collecting data about people for advertising and marketing causes no harm. There's no way to prove harm, and the burden's on individuals and people to prove that it does cause harm. And that was sort of the legal principle behind it in the United States. And what Cambridge Analytica has been sort of analogized to is sort of like a Valdez oil spill, a sort of deep water horizon event for the marketing and advertising world, because it implicates the entire ecosystem in what essentially is an environmental catastrophe of epic proportion.
Right. And it's galvanized all the people against people that were on the fringe of saying, I'm not sure about this, have all started looking with more attention and saying, well, let me really dig into this. And I don't like what I'm finding.
Exactly. It has a very similar effect in galvanizing opponents, and they can say, see, I told you so. You know, it vindicates critics. But what it really focuses on is that when we say, when it causes personal harm, we're asking the wrong question. It actually causes collective harm. It's more like pollution. It's more like, you know, an entire community is affected and cancer rates go up in a community, and nobody can say for sure that the fracking well or the Union Carbide plant in the neighborhood caused the illness, but it's a collective harm. So it's reshaping our thoughts about where we draw the line. And then this, at the same time when the European model is becoming more influential than it used to be in different ways. And so people are rethinking the European model and rethinking its merits and reconsidering, you know, its flaws. But the sort of reevaluation is broad. And it's pretty hard now to read an article in the press about Facebook or the sort of general topic without Cambridge Analytica being mentioned in the article as some sort of like reference point.
No, you're right. They're stitched together right now in the media narrative, and that's terrible for Facebook. But I feel like it's good for consumers to keep being reinforced, even for those who don't know exactly what the story is, that something happened with the data and it's not good for you, the end user. It's over the line.
It's interesting that there's it's a global household name because it affected many, many countries, not just the United States. And so it's almost this household term around the world. Any sort of news, any household that's sort of tuned in has probably heard the word in some kind of context and just has a negative association with it and probably strongly associates it with Facebook, but doesn't understand why. I doubt that, you know, the average person, there is such a thing, who was sort of polled and questionnaired and surveyed about, you know, couldn't clearly explain why they feel bad about it, but they could certainly clearly express a negative emotion about the whole escapade. So it speaks to the complexity of these issues, that they're visceral, even though they're complicated.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And the Exxon Valdez example is really smart. The way it became the one event that everybody could wrap their head around as the symptom of what was going on. So you started a business and you were using or learning about the data. If you were starting a business today, knowing now what you know, tell me what are your thoughts now for marketers or for business people as they have access to all this data? How do you think people can handle it responsibly? And you know, what have you learned or what is your viewpoint on it?
Well, it's, you know, in 2015, 2014, I have specific memory of sitting down with my developer, who was a co-founder, and we were doing our Facebook integration into our platform. And we were doing the API integration at the time, and the developer was showing me the incredible amount of personal data that we could, you know, harvest from getting someone to connect their Facebook account. And it was shocking and it was visceral to see what kind of probe we could just go in. And also just simply by installing sort of analytics platforms to study how users were using our platform, to learn how to make it better and to make a case to investors that it was worth investing in. That just the default right. settings allowed us to watch like individual users in real time click through the site. And it was an innocuous intent. It was just to sort of let you see what features were being used and, you know, what, you know, it was the whole point of the enterprise is to try stuff, see if it works, see if people will pay for it, see if you can start a business. That very fundamental necessity to build a business in the digital realm requires a sort of surveillance infrastructure by default. And the question is, you know, what is acceptable and what is invasive. And for me, just seeing how the sausage was made on the other side, building the stuff, seeing how the default settings were way more invasive than even I thought. When the company failed, I was sort of liberated to just sort of come out and say, I have some concerns about what's going on here, and I think it's going to blow up in everyone's faces. At the same time that I was doing this, there was a group of folks at Cambridge University doing the same thing, basically, using the Facebook social API to build a personality quiz that would harvest ultimately up to 87 million people's profiles and intimate traits about their life that they may not understand, and it may be used in ways that they would not expect. And if and certainly it was collected in a manner that was sort of surreptitious, that is collected for a very specific political purpose that was not disclosed at the time. And it's just, it showed the sort of recklessness of that era. And I think it was sort of the end of an era. And so to back to your question about what would you tell entrepreneurs today, it would be that the days of the Wild West have come to a close, and it's a good thing, and it can be good for business. But the question is recalibrating around it. And if the question for data, it becomes, you know, how to be just smarter about data and use it more wisely and economically, and sort of what is the economy of data collection, and how is data a liability and an asset? How does it represent profit and loss? You know, how is it a burden and an opportunity to create wealth? Having a sort of more balanced view of data would be the key thing that's different now.
Yes, I agree. You're nobody talks about how it where it can be a loss or where it can be a cost center. The prevailing model right now is just collect everything you can, scrape whatever you need to scrape, go get it. But nobody talks about the downside of gathering all that data or the responsibility of it. It's more just like, let's go get it.
Yes. And I think things like the European model and potentially things like the California privacy model that's just been passed, they point toward where the liability rests. It rests in the responsibility to individual users.
Got it.
To grant them access rights, which is something that businesses in the United States are not prepared for. So there'll be an initial cost to comply with the new requirements that will come that are already there in your Europe. But then once those costs are covered, then from there on, you'll see where the data is more of a liability in a company. Because the, for example, the retention requirements will change, and it becomes an obligation to get rid of data, or even just one person asking for their data can throw a corporation upside down because it has to be traced through a lot of the corporation, and most businesses are just not used to asking themselves this question. Where is all the data related to this person? And then what is the definition of personal data itself? That itself is a disputed across the Atlantic.
That's the question, because if we can't define that, if we can't agree on that, then we can't figure out where the line is of what's fair to collect and what's not fair to collect.
And what's remarkable about the regulatory after effect of Cambridge Analytica and Facebook that we can already see is the British data cop, the Information Commissioner's Office, the one who is responsible for regulating Cambridge Analytica, basically, and who fined Facebook for violating the Data Protection Act in principle, and is criminally prosecuting Cambridge Analytica and its related companies still. In its report called Democracy Disrupted, that was released last month, they talk specifically about inferred data as personal data. And this is a key question for marketers and advertisers alike, is a lot of what is traded as data is predictions and inferences about behavior. And some parties in the industry like to consider that non-personal data, even if it is attached to identities, and even if those identities are pseudonymous or somehow masked or aggregated. In the end, they really are inferences attached to individuals, even in the abstract, that the UK, Europe, et cetera, will moving forward view inferred data as personal data. That is, the minute you attach an inference about somebody to their identifier, it becomes personal data in that regime. And that's pretty significant, because what it means is that for example, the personality models that were created out of the University of Cambridge methodology and were derived from Facebook accounts and then were reattached to voter files to generate new predictive models. This is all absolutely, definitely personal data in the view of the regulators. So I think this is significant for the United States to grapple with, is that inferred behavior is personal data in the post-Cambridge Analytica world.
Well, let's grapple up with it a little bit here. So let's say by that logic, even doing like a broad MRI analysis of a demographic. So let's say we take 18 to 24 year old males, say across the US, and we pull all the habits of those people. That in itself is not personal, because it's super aggregated and there's no personal identifiers. But if I create a persona and then I start to say, well, they do these things and they go to the movies, you know, twice a month, and so therefore I think I can sell them a Dr. Pepper every time they go to this theater chain. Where's the line? Like, where does that become crossing that threshold into personal data using even something that I consider pretty broad, an MRI, which is great data for a marketer, but it's still not as specific as what we're offering up as consumers on social media.
I think what's really fascinating about the response to this question is the role of auditing and forensics to determine the technical moment where an inferred data point gets attached to an identity.
Yes.
And the Information Commissioner's Office has been conducting what is arguably the world's most complex and large and resourced data forensics investigation in history. And they have been reviewing hundreds of terabytes of data. And their interim report that was released in July just sort of comments on the things to come and the challenge of doing the forensics on all the data. But that in October, they anticipate reporting the details of the forensics. And I think at that point in October, we'll get a very important historical investigation yielding a really precise determination of where data got personal. And there'll be technical events that occurred where, for example, pseudonymous cookies were attached to voter files,
wow,
which were associated with Facebook accounts. And those precise moments would be where aggregates and lookalikes, et cetera, become PII in the industry parlance. That when pseudonymous identifiers get reattached to PII identifiers, of course, those are moments when we create personal data. But it is probably also moments where aggregate data or inferred or predictive data that comes from a model, which has a confidence value against it, when that gets attached to PII, you know, that those moments and what vendor was responsible. And, you know, that's where we get where the rubber hits the road.
Boy, that's going to be a moment of reckoning. That precedent that they're setting is going to be huge.
Yeah, there's so many different players in the complexity of this opaque ecosystem. And part of the challenge of the European model is creating accountability through the supply chain.
Well, yeah, because from the provider, from the Facebooks that are gathering data and harvesting it, and in some cases using it, to ad networks that are layering it, to the ad network, to the global advertising holding company networks that are using that to sell media or to do media buys, but even then down to individual small businesses that are using the self-serve Facebook system, the Google system, where they don't really have to know that much to go in and create a lookalike or create a model for a customer. So if they cross the line too, it's much more far reaching. This is going to be huge.
And I think it speaks to, you know, how significant the decision, for example, of Facebook to terminate their third-party data broker relationships in the aftermath of Cambridge Analytica, which would be sort of data matching on the back end. So you have data in Facebook, you have data matching on the front end and the back end. You have it on the front end with custom audiences where people can be matched by name on their Facebook account when an advertiser uploads contact lists. And then data matching on the back end where Facebook is enriching people's profiles through data brokers like Experian and Acxiom and others. And right. So the disruption of that on one end, I think, speaks to the challenge of being GDPR compliant, but also Facebook's necessity to be defensive in this new sort of reality and to be more conservative and cautious and careful about attaching personal data to predictive data.
Really interesting stuff. Let me ask you this theoretical, hypothetical question. You started a business in which you learned of how much data there was, and the business ultimately didn't succeed. So you were able to follow that data and start this quest. What if the business had succeeded? Do you think you would have had the discipline to make the attempt at handling data differently? Or do you think you would have just kind of gone with the flow and kept using what was available? Or have you thought about that at all?
Sure. It's a great question. It's similar to the question that I get is like, if Hillary Clinton had won the presidency, like, would I even care about Cambridge Analytica? Well, it's hard to answer that question. I won't cop out to it. I will take a stab at it. But it's hard to answer that question because I was not able to raise money to fund it. And that's ultimately why it died, is I couldn't get even enough seed investors to build it to even successfully test market it. And some of that was probably because I just had an ethical dilemma and couldn't get over it in order to get investors, that they probably sensed my unease because if, you know, it should be easy enough to get investment in a startup that uses terms like AI and machine learning, even a couple of years ago. But I wasn't able.
It should be a slam dunk.
Exactly.
Right?
People should have been throwing money at me because on paper, it looked good. Had all the right things in certain ways. So nobody would write me a check after Hearst, beyond some for friends and family. So why? What was that? And it was because I was not selling it hard enough the way it had to be sold. And was I not sort of driven by data monetization in a way that was required by investors? So it's hard to imagine because I definitely had all the stakes, all the pressure of starting a business, and that wasn't enough.
All right. Well, Professor Carroll, David, thank you so much for being here. This was an really, really great conversation. I know I learned a lot. I have a feeling if you and I were together, we could talk about this more, just on the hypotheticals of where the lines are and what's potentially right and wrong and what makes them so. So thank you for making time. I appreciate it.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right. Awesome.